It's 9:15 p.m. at 113 East 38th Street, and you're listening to Night Call.
Night Call.
And welcome to Night Call, a podcast for your strange days and lonely nights. I'm Tess Lynch in Los Angeles, and with me is special guest Karina Longworth.
Hi.
Over in New York, we have, as always,
Emily Yoshida.
Hi, guys.
Hi. I'm so excited to have Karina on the show. It feels like it's been long overdue.
Yes, absolutely.
And for those of you who do not know, who have been living in a cave, Karina hosts You Must Remember This, a really, really great podcast about Hollywood history and scandal and all sorts of juicy stuff that is it's on hiatus right now, correct?
But yeah.
But if you haven't listened to it, you can go back and discover a whole wealth of podcast episodes past.
So, you should also read her books. Her newest one, I believe, is Seduction, Sex, yes. Lies, and Stardom in Howard Hughes Hollywood, and it's amazing. So you should definitely get that. But yeah, I think You Must Remember This is definitely like Night Call adjacent. We've all been big fans for a long time, so we're really happy to have Karina here.
Yeah,
thank you. I'm happy to be here. I'm a fan of Night Call.
Yay. Why, thank you.
I'm so excited to talk about erotic thrillers.
Oh, yeah. It's like, it's really great how much this series of ours has brought people out of the woodwork. Like, there are a lot of kind of secret enthusiasts who are like, oh, when are you going to do mine? Like, my favorite. We wanted to start off real quick just to acknowledge our new superstar, the black hole that was imaged, I should say, for the first time last week. So this is sort of old news by the time you're hearing this. But we just wanted to give it a little bit of a shout out. Where were you when you saw the black hole for the first time?
The black hole blip. Yeah, where were you, Karina?
I think I had just turned on the shower and I was waiting for it to heat up and I was looking at it on my phone.
Nice. Oh, dangerous. Dangerous. I live that way too. This black hole has a name. And it has a couple of names, actually. It just got a Hawaiian name. But it was originally M87 star.
You know how long star, I guess. It took me to realize that M83, the musical act / band, was named after a star system?
It took me until I was today years old.
Forever. Well, it's a really beautiful one. So he picked a good one. But and it's very appropriate once you think about it because it's very like galactic music. Like you feel very starry-eyed when you're listening to it. But yes. I had no idea until like a year ago. So, but yeah, M87 is the new hot galaxy in town. I know that there's been a lot of little mini stories coming out about it, and like the woman who actually was kind of spearheading the entire project, who was kind of credited later on down the road. Of course, we tend to lose credit for our women in STEM and astronomy and stuff like that. But that was interesting. But I think I like just reading what people felt seeing it for the first time.
What kind of reactions did you see? I missed this.
I think Jezebel had a good post where it was just like, they just opened up the comments and said, like, tell us how you feel about the black hole. And of course, a lot of it is jokes. Like, a lot of people had a lot of good jokes about the black hole. But I think it's interesting because it's something that, you know, you feel like you've seen a zillion times because we've seen like recreations of them in sci-fi movies or, you know, in a Time Life science book or something like that. Like you kind of know what a black hole is supposed to look like, but actually seeing an actual one is very, it is an interesting feeling. I like it. I like to ponder the black hole.
It kind of looks like an ultrasound image of an eyeball.
Yeah.
A little bit, you know, with like all the kind of strata and the like orangey kind of background.
Yeah.
It's a little bit too much for me. I think we've now been talking about the ultra black holes on the floor, you know, and now black hole, like there's been a whole kind of
the art holes.
Art holes, black holes, Molly's fear of holes.
Yes,
is now little well holes. Known. The little holes. After we finish the erotic thrillers, we should just do holes. And then we could do the movie holes.
Well, please give us a night call at 1-240-46-NIGHT and tell us how the black hole made you feel or any other thoughts you might have about the black hole. We welcome them all. The black hole is evergreen content, I feel like.
It is. And literally, expire. I mean, it's, yeah, it's timeless, literally.
Yes.
Yeah, and spatially expanding.
8, 5, 12, 12, 15.
This week's episode of Night Call is brought to you by Cheers Health. So it is spring. It's time for everybody to come out of their hibernation holes and socialize again and remember what it feels like to have human contact. I know that I've been doing a lot of that recently. It's weird. It's uncomfortable. It also involves a drink or two every now and then. Everybody likes a good spring rosé here and there. Wedding season's coming up. You might want to tie one or two on. Do people say tie one on anymore? It's very old. I sound like an old, old lady, which I am. I am an old lady who used to be able to, you know, have a few drinks and wake up the next morning and feel more or less fine. But I have experienced in my elderly age, as I'm sure that many of you have, that sometimes it's a little harder to bounce back from two or three or four or five drinks in a night. The way that you used to. And that is where Cheers Health is here to save the day. Cheers Health is the product for responsible drinking and drinkers. Like an antacid for alcohol, Cheers neutralizes alcohol's negative effects so you can wake up feeling great after a night of drinking. I now actively swear by it, not just on ads here on Night Call, but in person with other people. It really does make a huge difference. You feel up to 50% better the next morning than you would otherwise without Cheers Health. And it's healthy for your liver, and it really helps you just get the day back when you might otherwise feel a little sluggish or under the weather the next day. To use Cheers, you simply take 2 to 4 capsules after your last alcohol beverage or before you go to bed. And if you don't wake up feeling at least 50% better the next day, you get your money back guaranteed. So Night Call listeners, get your day back after an evening of responsible adult beverage drinking. To order, go to cheershealth.com, enter the promo code NIGHTCALL, all one word, at checkout to get 10% off of your first order and a free gift. That is cheershealth.com. Promo code NIGHTCALL, NIGHTCALL, for 10% off and a free gift with your first order. With Cheers, you're going to start feeling better when you wake up, and your liver is going to thank you. Cheers, the best thing to happen to alcohol since alcohol.
12, 9, 20, 5, 14, 5, 18, 19. Guys, we are on our way to wrapping up our erotic thriller odyssey.
We are going to be speaking about Sliver, the 1993 film.
Woo woo.
By Phil Noyce.
Philly Noyce.
I love the last name, Noyce.
it's really appropriate for this movie.
It is, yes.
We're going to get to that in the second half because, oddly, some recent interesting stories have fit right into our wheelhouse. Namely, the Bloomberg article that came out last week about Alexa and other home, what's the general term
smart
for these?
Smart home devices.
Smart home devices. Apparently, there's an Apple one I've never heard of, so I guess they're not doing a very good job with that one called HomePod. But there's also the Google Home. But Alexa, I feel like, is the one that everybody has, and the Echo. Do either of you have an Alexa or Echo?
No, but my phone like always thinks I'm talking to
yes.
me. Like Siri is always trying to just like wedge her way into my conversations.
Yeah.
I'm surprised she didn't just say something.
I turned my phone off. But I mean, I had dental work done last week, and for some reason Siri kept thinking I was saying her name more than usual because I was like mumbling.
Oh.
So anytime I would say anything that with an S sound, she would be like, "I don't understand."
See, I thought I had the Siri thing turned on because I can actually see some use for that if I am, you know, washing the dishes or cooking something and I just need like to know what time it is
but
or something.
But it never works.
No,
it's
never works.
It's never what you want.
Yeah.
Like she never is actually helpful.
Yeah.
She's never able to like find like the contact you want her to find or put on the podcast you want her to put on.
Yeah.
Whenever I'm like, tell me how long it's going to take to get to blank place. She's like, do you want me to make you a reservation?
No. That's not what I asked.
She wants you to put down money.
I don't have any smart things. I don't like the smart. I turned Siri off and thought she was completely off. And then she was like, hello. And I was like, no, you're off. But I got really creeped out about privacy. Not that I really have any secrets, but I tried to like lock everything down a while ago. But a friend of mine just said that Alexa, she's a teacher, and Alexa was like chiming in her classroom with like
racy
content. Yeah, I mean, it's just Alexa. None of them have any tact.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
So this article that came out, it was by a team of people at Bloomberg, Matt Day, Giles Turner, and Natalia Drozdiak. The difference between like having Siri on the phone, it's like you're going to get a phone anyway, and it's like a piece of software that comes on the phone that you theoretically can disable. But Alexa is expressly for the purpose of having a robot that listens to you and takes your data and uses it to, quote, get smarter. And so this was a report they did where they talked to a lot of people who worked at these centers. Some are within Amazon itself, and some of them are outsourced to other companies where, in a way, I feel like we've seen a lot of stories similar to this in recent years. There are people whose job it is to just listen to your recordings, like listen to the stuff that all these Alexas pick up, because it's not just a robot that is artificial intelligencing its way to tell you about a restaurant that you might want, may or may not want to go to. A lot of times these are going to actual humans who then figure out what to do with that data or try to get better at recognizing what you're saying and why you're asking certain questions and stuff like that. But like in the meantime, of course, they pick up all sorts of stuff that you might not actually want anybody to hear, such as in one case in the report, a sexual assault or a probable sexual assault. And it talks about the people who work at these centers picking up on this stuff and sharing it with everybody in, I guess, like a Slack channel or something. But it's not like for a means of reporting it. It's like they just talk about it like, yeah, you're stressed out because you heard this, so you want to share it with people, or like you want to make fun of somebody singing in the shower that it picked up or something, which is like really creepy. I don't know. Like,
yeah,
it would be one thing if it was like, oh, we heard this and we need to figure out what legally we're, you know, what we need to do around what we think we're hearing right now. But a lot of times it feels like it's just like, LOL, or, oh my God, isn't this creepy, and nothing being done. Not that I think,
right,
not that you necessarily want the authorities to come and rush and help you or something because your robot heard you, but I don't know.
I'm sure the robot is not that great at like determining consent.
No, right? No, yes. Not at all. But like, you know, the robot picks it up and then the humans hear it. And then you have a morality question where before perhaps it was a different morality question.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I just think it's wild that anybody paid to put these in their homes. Like, you're like doing the work for people. Like, you're paying to wear a wire. It's just... Yeah.
There were a couple of other articles this week, too, which will now be a week old for our listeners. But I'm sure there will be three more articles about the exact same thing. One of them was How Capitalism Betrayed Privacy by Tim Wu in The New York Times, which kind of talked about how privacy was initially thought of as being kind of like a rich person's, you know, only rich people had access to it. And, you know, poorer people lived in more of like a communal living with less expectation of privacy. And then gradually how the rise of the middle class afforded more people the right to privacy. And now, because the gatekeepers are all interested in our data and behavior, that it's kind of turning around where the expectation of privacy is no longer like, you know, it's being kind of eroded. And then there was also a really scary article. CNBC, I think, reported that 22% of organizations are starting to track employee movement. And Amazon and Walmart have both, they have like the patents on the kind of their sensors that track both movement and are listening for like the rustling of bags and conversations between the cashiers and the customers.
Oh, I didn't
and the beeps
see this.
Of the scanner.
Oh, yes. God. I hate it.
Yes. It's horrible. It's very interesting because these things are all so terrifying when you kind of come across them and they've been going on. I mean, if you start to look up about how long people have been saying like, oh, I think my phone is listening to me despite the denials of these companies. We started talking about it a few years ago.
Oh,
it had already been a discussion for years before that. But it's just bizarre how little there is to grab onto even now in terms of, you know, like a really trustworthy conversation about whether or not that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like everybody has an opinion now about whether or not their phone is listening to them, especially Instagram.
Yeah, Karina, where do you fall?
Oh, definitely. My devices are absolutely, you know, I know because of the ads I get for stuff, right? Like, it will be extremely bizarre of almost even, like, not saying things out loud, just feeling like, thinking did I say that out loud?
Yeah.
Like, I thought I just thought that.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, you know, you could buy a you know, steampunk laundry hamper. You know?
It's like you've done enough other actions that, like, algorithmically would lead you to the steampunk laundry hamper.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I did buy.
You did?
What does that look like? What is that?
The aesthetic is more like, it's like what would be in the orphanage in Return to Oz.
Okay.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Like a metal sort of wire thing with wheels and then like a big canvas bag inside.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And no gargoyles or anything.
No gargoyles.
Yeah, okay.
But, I mean, I guess I could attach one.
You could.
Or like an attachable umbrella, like a really spire-like umbrella. Yeah.
Yeah. Not a bad idea.
Yeah. I feel like I remember running into so much resistance about this, or people really acting as if I was a conspiracy theorist. Like, that was the only thing I really seriously, I think, honestly believed something kind of in that realm that felt conspiracy-ish and was not universally met with people being like, oh, yeah, though, that's definitely happening. Like, when I was working at a tech site, a lot of people were like, that's a common crackpot conspiracy and you are dumb for thinking that. But now, I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't know where the consensus is on it now, because I feel like more and more people are just, like, reporting these things. You see it, like, every single day.
Why do you think people get defensive as if it's not a thing? It seems
as
though...
It's obviously a thing.
It's obviously a thing, and yet people are like, no, 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 you have to believe it's not a thing, which seems to me to be a very crazy stance.
Because it's these people who have bought in so much to, like, overall tech culture, where they have put enough of their chips on the thing of, like, I am going to get into the lifestyle where I do get all the things. I'm an early adopter on everything.
Right.
I'm going to put all my data on the cloud and that's owned by Google or Apple or whoever. And this is, like, not just a choice of convenience or something. This is kind of like a – it's like a principle. It's like, it's like a lifestyle choice. It's like a set of beliefs. And so if you're – if somebody questions the, I don't know, practicality or, you know, how wise it is to actually do all of this stuff, then it does start to feel personal, I think, for people.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, at one point it was – all of that stuff was, like, viably utopian. And now it just seems like there's no way you could not see it as dystopian.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like nuke codes or something. Like, you've created this thing that, you know – is now potentially much more if it were to fall in the wrong hands, if it's not already in the wrong hands.
It's already in the wrong hands. Whose hands could be worse?
There's no there's no right hands in late capitalism.
This is, like, tangentially related, because one of the things I also always would pick up on is that I would talk about something, like a place or a business, and then it would pop up on my Google Maps. It wouldn't be a place I had gone. It was just a place maybe I was talking about with somebody. And now Google Maps, when you're doing directions on it, it will – and I don't think this is, like, the same phenomenon, but it's just, like, it just sucks. It'll say, like, take a right, not at the street that you're at,
yes,
but, like, at the Starbucks.
In-N-Out.
Yeah. It's so – I hate it so much.
It's very strange.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
but are those placements that are being bought?
I think so.
I think they have to be, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I'm getting ones that are, like, really inconsistent with any place I go. Like, Arby's.
Right.
I get a ton of Arby's. Yeah. And I'm just like, I don't know. I've, like, totally blocked out Arby's in my field of vision. Like, I don't see them. And then it's like, where's the, I don't know where the Arby's is.
Yeah.
Just tell me where to take a right.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating.
It's a giant light-up cowboy hat. You can't miss it.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It was my grandmother's favorite restaurant, Arby's.
I love an Arby's.
Arby's. It's a divisive topic, honestly. There was a quote in, I think it was the New York Times op-ed, and it said that once you, I'm not going to read it, but I'll just summarize because it was kind of long, but once you realize that you're being watched or that you're being surveilled, you can't, like, continue to act authentically. You can't shake that feeling, and it totally changes, like, your behavior in general. So, like, what you've really lost once you acknowledge that you're being surveilled all the time is your soul.
And that's what Sliver is about.
And yeah. that's what Sliver is about.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Before we get to Sliver, do you guys want to take a night call?
Let's take a night call.
Hey, night call. My name's Bree. I'm calling from Aliso Viejo, California, and it is 6:44 a.m. I heard you guys on this week's episode talking about Tippi Hedren's Big Cat Preserve, and I've actually been there. I was in junior college, and I randomly took a wild animal class, wild animal handling, something like that. And we actually took a field trip to the preserve, and it was actually really cool. They had a lot of interesting things there. One of them they talked about was a three-legged cheetah who they said could still run, you know, about 30 miles per hour, even with three legs. There was also, they talked about how they had a tigon, which is a tiger father, liger mom. And then the liger mom gave birth to a tigon, which is when it's a tigon who has now bred with a tiger dad. So that was pretty cool. It was definitely an interesting experience, but I'm all for, you know, people helping out these big cats that have either been abandoned by zoos or by weird people who think that they should probably have a tiger in their house. You know, there's a lot of strange people out there. All right, night call. Have a great day.
You know what's funny, just as a side note, is how often we get all of our calls through Google Voice and it automatically transcribes it. And half the time when people say hi, night call, it transcribes as hi, Michael.
All the time.
So I feel like, it's like our podcast is now
Michael.
our pseudonym is Michael as a group,
yes, absolutely.
As a trio.
I didn't realize that different species of wild cats could diversify like that.
No, I did not know about a tigon. That's new.
No. Sounds like Game of Thrones.
It's good to know they're all horny for each other.
Exactly. Maybe it's just the sanctuary lifestyle. It's like
totally.
Gets everyone
like
loosened up.
Plato's retreat for cats.
Have either of you ever been to the Tippi Hedren Preserve? I know one person who has, I think, for a story, a profile of her, but it seems pretty wild. I can't believe it's still there. And I've never seen Roar either, which, like, I guess I don't know, I'm saving it for the right moment or something, but I've always wanted to.
We should cover that. Yeah, I haven't either. I have mixed feelings about I mean, I'm glad the sanctuaries exist, but it's just I find it increasingly difficult to just look at animals in cages. Yeah.
Well, they're not in cages, though, right?
Aren't I know, they just, but like, it's like they're just kind of – I mean, it's probably enclosed in some way.
Right.
It's, like,
there's
big,
a fence.
Though.
Yeah.
But it's, like, it's just odd to me. It just doesn't, like – doesn't really – no thrill for me. It's just, like, sadness, a little layer of sadness and just, like, worrying about the world.
There is something interesting about the fact that Tippi Hedren, like, has her cat thing and then Doris Day has, like, gone into seclusion, like, with her animals.
Oh.
But she doesn't have, like, a – public place where you can visit them. She just like supposedly collects sort of stray animals.
Is she
and,
one of
like,
these people who has like
I didn't know about
like the pythons in her house or something? Or
I don't know if they're exotic at all. Okay. It might just be like cats and dogs. But she, you know, she's kind of like disappeared from the public eye over the past 20 years or so. She doesn't give any interviews or anything. But like the only sort of public stuff she does is animal rescue initiatives. And she supposedly, like, lives on a ranch somewhere, like, and it's just her and her animals. She's outlived, like, her whole family,
when
she ever knew, so.
Only barely related to this, I was looking at Yelp reviews for the Bunny Museum. Have you guys ever been to the Bunny Museum?
No.
It's a museum. I think it used to be in, like, a little house and has now moved. But I went there once in high school, and it's, like, it's just basically a bunch of like bunny memorabilia and then a few bunnies in very close quarters, and you don't know what it is, and you make a long drive to get there, and then it's like it's just a very intense experience that I would say probably 10% of the people who go there respond well to. The others are like, what have I done?
Is it like a cat cafe for bunnies? Because I've done that before in Japan.
No, it is like you're not really encouraged to interact with the live bunnies. You're encouraged to like take in the stuffed bunnies and the bunny kind of like
your
bunny
voice makes it sound
things.
Like the biggest just, bummer in the world.
I get a panic attack talking about it. I just had to like rid myself. But you can just read the Yelp reviews and get a really, really good sense of what it is. I was looking into it recently because I was like, bunny museum sounds familiar, but I'm sure it's not the same one I went to. Maybe I want to go. Oh, no, it is the same one and I'm not going to go to that. You know, it's a mixed bag when you go into the place where there are a lot of animals.
It's
enclosed.
It is really, really weird. Like there, I watched this actually really great short film that I was on a jury in a festival in Italy for. So it was this film about these, like this group of old Italian men who are all like hunting for this mythical panther that's been seen by people, like, and occasionally will like eat a sheep or something, but apparently was owned, like, I guess, by somebody in the 60s or 70s or something, when it was like, I guess that was a trend again in Italy, like among the rich people, to have, you know, these exotic pets that then they would get big and they couldn't take care of anymore. So I guess it's somewhat common for these like panthers and cheetahs and stuff to just be like hanging out, you know, in Tuscany or whatever.
That's amazing.
It was a fascinating short.
I will see that too.
Yeah, I wonder if it's if it's available to screen anywhere or stream. I will put a link somewhere for it because it's great.
Excellent. Guys, we have to talk about Sliver.
Yes.
I'm really excited to talk about this movie. It makes no sense. It makes no sense.
It's a proto cyber thriller. I love
yes.
it.
But it took me it was a long journey for me.
Our erotic odyssey.
Exactly.
That's right.
For those of you who don't know.
Because you really have to talk about the end
yeah,
of it.
You have to talk about the ending. You have to talk about the ending that almost was.
Right.
This is a 1993 movie based on an Ira Levin novel he did Separate Wives and Rosemary's Baby, directed by Philip Noyce, as we said, and of course it's Joe Esterhaus. So let's go.
Well, first of all, Karina, this was a pick of yours. This is one we had wanted to do, but then we asked you if you wanted to be on the show and if you wanted to talk about an erotic thriller, and we were also kind of talking about what you felt like maybe the original erotic thriller was, or the history at least of the genre. But then we were like, oh, we just want to watch Sliver because, of course.
Basically.
But what – and I know you said that this was a particular favorite of yours. So what – when did you first see it and why did you respond to it, do you think?
So I saw this movie in the theater when I was in seventh grade.
Ooh.
I don't know how that was possible. I don't remember there being any trouble buying a ticket to it. I know I went with a girlfriend of mine like after school on a Friday afternoon at Universal City Walk.
Nice.
And I just remember like really loving it at age 12 and a half. And part of it was like it had a big hit soundtrack. It had that UB40.
The UB40 song.
I think there was like a couple of other sort of hit songs. And so it just felt like so hip and adult and sexy. And I was a sort of a fledgling goth and I was wearing a lot of black chokers and Sharon Stone wears a choker in like three scenes of this movie while also kind of pioneering athleisure.
Yeah.
It's true. In these incredible like leggings and like cashmere coat looks.
Yes.
Yeah. The straight from the gym like to the bedroom look.
Yeah.
<It's good.
laughs> Yeah. But then I saw it a lot after that. I think it was on TV a lot. And then there was a period around 2003 where I'd been living in San Francisco and I was going to move to New York, but I was still hanging around after I had to give up my apartment. And so I was staying with a friend of mine who had like a big like Victorian apartment in sort of on the border of Chinatown in San Francisco. And she was on disability for being depressed. And so she didn't have to go to a job. She just was able to live in this Victorian apartment and paint all day. And she liked to paint with movies on in the background. And her favorite thing to put on was Vertigo.
Ooh,
but sometimes she'd alternate it with Sliver.
Wow.
And she would just watch the two of those movies like over and over again. And I remember sitting there for like 3 days reading the book that guy, Steve Hodell, wrote about how his dad killed the Black Dahlia while this woman was watching Sliver over and over again.
Ooh.
That is a mood. So,
yeah, it's not not depressing.
So that was August 2003 for me.
Wow. It's funny because I was talking about like real estate horror and I feel like there should be more of it. And then it's like, well, this feels like maybe one of five movies I can think of off the top of my head that I would consider real estate horror.
Well, Karina read the book and I think the book is way more about the physical place, the apartment, and kind of like less about whatever these social dynamics
turn into. But it's also like, I mean, I haven't read the book since 1993. Yeah. Like, because I love the movie so much as a 12 and a half year old. And then, like, I was like, I need more. And so I read the book then. So I don't remember it that well. But I do remember it, that there was more of this element of kind of like corporate satire.
Right.
You know, and there, I mean, I guess we should talk about what the plot of the movie is, but there are conversations in the movie where at first they're like, who even owns this building?
Yeah.
Right. Who could it be? And then it turns out it's just Billy Baldwin.
Yeah. Billy Baldwin, interesting choice for me, like, for this role.
Yeah. I mean, he makes much more sense as the guy with the manga posters and like three different screensavers, like in 1983 going on, and like some weird fiber optic sculpture in his apartment, than like the sexy guy, like the sexy voyeur. Like, I don't.
Yeah.
One half of those works more for me than the other.
And as great as Sharon Stone's wardrobe was in this movie, like his was just a really bold, really strange choice of the graphic t-shirt with rolled sleeves, I mean, tucked into the jeans.
He looks
like a guy in Brooklyn now, though. That's the crazy thing. It's like it's come full circle.
I know, it's true. Well, a lot about this movie is like more timely than it seems like it was in 93. But yeah, we should talk briefly about the plot.
The plot, yes.
Which, let's untangle it. So we have Carly, Sharon Stone, and she is, I forget, she's an editor, publisher, executive, or something like that.
A hot book.
She's working on a James Dean biography that she has to like edit really fast. And I wish she had edited it and published it because there are no good James Dean biographies.
It's true. It sounded like she was, you know, that she was, she had a good repertoire and that was like slumming it a little bit. So it would have been great. Then she is moving into an apartment which is known as 113. The Wikipedia for this film says that the building is located at 113 East 38th Street, but the actual building used in the movie was Morgan Court, which is a couple of blocks away on Madison. It is the sliver building because it looks like a little slice.
Yeah.
Of a building.
And apparently those were, like, you couldn't build those for a while, I guess, before or after, like, this big boom of them. But now I feel like they've come back, baby, in, like, bigger and more obtrusive form. But I like that it was, like, considered, I guess it was, like, a very, like, au courant architectural style to, like, frame a horror movie or like, a suspense movie around or something. But yeah, it's, you know, it's this very desirable, exclusive building, and she applies and she gets in. And, you know, very shortly after she moves in, she realizes that the previous tenant was murdered, which we see in the
opening. And looks just like her.
Yes.
Yes, Naomi Singer.
Yeah. And she meets some of the people who live in the building, and one of them happens to be this author, this, like, crime author played by Tom Berenger, who I guess her company is like trying to get her to work with, but she's just
but
not
he's super
him.
Creepy he's and very harassing. Creepy.
Yeah. And then also Billy Baldwin, who is not creepy. No, he's
so creepy.
He's also creepy too. They're
he's
both
a
creepy.
Video game designer.
He's a computer like, video game designer, I'll have you know.
Yes, yes. Okay, fair. And his like signature flirtation move is to like hack into people's desktop computers and be like, hello, I love you.
He's Ghostwriter.
And then send them clip art of a flower.
the rose clip art thing is incredible.
So creepy.
Nothing and more 1993.
Nobody in this movie has a sense of humor. And also, I have to shout out Sharon Stone's office mate, her coworker, who is like, ooh, so off the rails and constantly talking about vibrators in a really unrealistic. There's a realistic way to do it, I swear, but it's not happening in this movie.
Played by the great Colleen Camp.
Yes, Colleen Camp. Yeah, a bunch of like great talent in this movie, like it's, you know, just like weird cat. I was like, where's Michael Douglas for this William Baldwin role? But alas.
Well, I mean, Alec Baldwin would have been better casting because I feel like Alec Baldwin's the only Baldwin who is like legitimately scary and menacing.
Yeah.
Whereas Billy Baldwin, it's like, it would just be so easy to be like, you know what? I'm just like not going to hang out with you anymore. Like, I'm not worried about repercussions of that.
Yeah. He can't really get his hooks in.
I feel like a Rupert Everett I would like in that role better. Like, I would want like a really gorgeous, possibly British person who's like.
Yeah, British would have been better for sure.
Who like feels like a pasty indoor kid, but is also beautiful. Yeah. Like, I don't know.
Also, there's just something really confusing about the character's seduction of like approaching her with a very aggressive, listen, do you work out?
Yeah.
And then
he's
like, come on, you're going to, she was like, what, treadmills? He was like, no, we're going to lift weights. And then like drags her down to the gym where she just like watches him lift weights.
That it's when I realized that they were going to go to the gym, I was like, yes, gym scene in 1993, baby.
No mirrors.
I was going to do this piece about Equinox at one point. So I was doing all this research and there's a piece about like when Equinox is having its boom in the early 90s. That's like just a wonderful slice of New York in 1993. So I was into that. Oh, she also gets a telescope one of those spyglass type things in her window. Somebody gives it to...
Admirer.
Yeah, it's later revealed that it was Billy Baldwin, but she just thinks a secret admirer dropped it off, and so she's like also staring, like spying on her neighbors a little bit. She has a cocktail party, and they watch the neighbors have sex, and it's like, oh, she's into the voyeur thing. But in the meantime, another person dies in the building. The
NYU film professor guy.
Oh, right. Yeah, he dies.
Yeah.
The film professor dies. The cokey fashion designer dies.
Vida. Played by Polly Walker, who's really good in things and is kind of good in this, but also like a very strange character,
right.
I thought.
Yeah.
Just sort of the like very high strung artist.
I feel like there's a lot in this movie where, I mean, I think that at one point it had an NC-17 rating and then they cut it. But the big thing they cut was naked Billy Baldwin.
Oh,
but
man.
It also just feels like they cut out a lot of sort of narrative context.
Right.
Like, it is apparent that the Vida character is a prostitute.
Really?
But only if you like really listen to like one of her phone conversations.
Yes.
And then like there's all this stuff where it's sort of hinted that Sharon Stone has just left a marriage that was abusive in some
7 years. Yeah. 7 years.
And she's pregnant? Is she pregnant?
Okay, thank you. There's a part pretty early on in the movie where it's before she gets, she takes the bath.
A really good bath.
A really great bath. She starts like stroking her stomach and like looking depressed in the mirror. And I was like, oh, she's pregnant.
Right. And she's also been looking at the party across the way and she's like very obviously not partying. And so I was like, oh, she's like not drinking. But then she's drinking later at her own cocktail party. So I don't know.
I saw that more as like she's already said she's 35. She's been in this marriage for 7 years. She didn't have a baby. And she's just like, you know, regretting that she's not pregnant.
As we all do by holding our bellies at some point.
Yeah, just thinking.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there's, you know, there's a lot of stuff in this movie that's clumsy. And I don't know if it's because of like the necessity to edit it for censorship or for, as we'll get to, like test screening reasons.
Yeah.
But then there's a lot of stuff that I think feel like I appreciate the subtlety. And I don't know if it's intentional or not. But first of all, like the first like hour of this movie is incredibly slow.
Yeah.
It's
almost
like a European movie. And you're just kind of watching this like, you know, not middle age, but like slightly older than ingenue age woman, like kind of living her life and it like exploring like what kind of person she's gonna be there's like creepy men everywhere, but she's like kind of willing to hear them out in a way that's interesting and exposes who they are more than it exposes who she is. And there's just like some interesting stuff where it really does feel like it's kind of like a post-European update on Hitchcock. And then there's also, you know, like wacky sex scenes.
I mean, I really like her character in this. It isn't just one thing. It's like she is just a gal who's like works a lot and is sort of interested in dating, but not in like this super like all consuming, like it's her whole reason for being that she needs to find a man. Like she's not going to go to a Pavarotti concert.
Well, really long scene about Pavarotti.
Yeah, again, that's the opera square strange. On the erotic thriller bingo.
Yes.
But yeah, like it seems like she likes her job. It seems like she's pretty successful. She like wants to be dating, but she's not really, it's not like she's going to just jump into bed with whoever until she meets Billy Baldwin. Like their relationship is sort of interesting in that kind of 9.5 weeks way where it's like you're kind of through the relationship, you're watching somebody figure out like what they're into. I think like obviously it leans a little, it's a little less up for interpretation in this film than in 9.5 weeks. But
I mean, the thing that we haven't said is that Billy Baldwin, like, he owns the building. Yeah. And the reason why that's important is because he has cameras in every single room. And he has, like, a control room, which he brags cost $6 million for him to build in 1993.
He got it built in Osaka.
And he's just able to watch every apartment and every room in every apartment at any time. Yeah. And so after he started having sex with Sharon Stone, he like reveals this to her. And at first she's fascinated by it. And she sits there for like apparently 24 hours at a time, just watching the video.
She stops eating. And, like it's like all consuming. And I feel like that just felt to me like, oh, this is when somebody like discovers the internet for the first time.
Yes,
it is totally like it completely changes your perspective on, I don't know. It's like it's addictive because it's new and it's a new way of getting information, and it's information that you never had access to before. And so it's just like you have no way to stop yourself. You don't have any of
also. Her reaction to seeing this is so impassive, which is really surprising because you would think that she would be. I mean, it's revealed that like he has tapes of, you know, the two of them having sex and he plays it for her. He also later we find out has taped himself having sex with a bunch of other people. He has those tapes underneath his shoes in a little trapdoor thing. And like some of the stories, like we get like a little kind of like plot diversion into a incest kind of thing that's going on. That's like, you know, she just, her reactions are really subtle to the fact that these, like, while she's watching all of these different tapes,
right,
you would expect her to be more upset at Zeke or want to do something more,
right,
which is much like we watch, you know, like taking in news on the internet or just like watching,
right,
scrolling through people's lives. It's like this hypnotic thing
it
where
numbs
you just
her.
Don't really react. Yeah.
Like they really, I mean, they really oversell it, I think, but like doing this thing where she is just instantly, she does have a first reaction of being horrified and disgusted by this and is about to walk out. And then turns around and it's like she stares at the screen 5 seconds too long and then is like, oh
yeah,
I must watch more.
Right,
which is very, I mean, yeah, it feels it feels understandable. And I wonder, like, the reception of this film, I mean, the negative reception right now, it's like gotten 11% on Rotten Tomatoes or something like that. Yeah. But is that, I mean, about the far-fetchedness of it or something? Because I feel like that is less of a problem now than maybe it was in 1993.
Yeah, I don't really remember what the reception was like. Like amongst me and like my middle school, like the reception was very high. Like maybe 13-year-olds are the ideal audience for this movie.
Yeah.
Right.
But also I think it was just like it was post Basic Instinct and I think people were expecting kind of a higher level of sophistication in terms of storytelling.
Yeah. Basic Instinct was the year before?
Yeah.
Or? I think Basic Instinct was 91, but
91,
I'm not sure.
Okay. So maybe 2 years before. I read like a couple of old reviews of it, and my main problem. So the crazy thing about this movie is that the ending was changed.
Yeah,
an original ending was shot. It didn't test well. There was also a horrible accident that was, involved in the shooting of the first ending. So the original ending and this is the big spoiler is that Zeke has been killing the people. There are, you know, three or four people who have died in 113, and he has killed them, and he confesses this to Carly while they're in a helicopter in Hawaii over a volcano, and then he flies the helicopter into the volcano.
Wait, what?
Yes, Emily. Yes.
That's such
and
a good...
And then you don't know... You don't know whether or not they survive. So basically, this was scrapped for two reasons, I guess. Number one being that the actual helicopter crashed the filming.
Oh, my God.
And the pilot's license was revoked. I don't know if anyone was hurt or killed. Like, it just seems like a mess. And they destroyed the footage. So, and I guess audiences also had a problem with the fact that they were like, oh, Carly, like, forgives the killer. That makes her so, you know, unlikable. I just, you know, now I hate everyone in the movie. So they're like, oh, okay, like, let's figure out something else. Now we'll make Tom Berenger the murderer.
Which makes sense in, to some extent because he's just creepy. Like, right. He's super never creepy. Anything but creepy.
Yeah.
But here's my issue, and I pressed Karina on this earlier. But if Zeke, Billy Baldwin, has been watching these tapes of people, and he claims at one point, he's like, I never saw anyone die. One, the Naomi Singer was pushed off her balcony. You know, it's like maybe they frame it as like a suicide, but it seems obvious that everyone's suspicious. The man, is it two people fell in the shower? One person falls in the shower.
Well, the old man
falls
in the shower. But I get the feeling that that was just like he just had a heart attack or something.
But the police are suspicious.
Yeah.
Like they're questioning everyone
because
right
people
afterwards.
Keep dying in that building. But it could be a coincidence. But then the cokey model slash prostitute dies as well.
Yeah.
It's just interesting to me that Zeke could be the kind of character who's like, people keep dying mysteriously, and I have footage of, like, the entire building. Isn't that weird? Huh. What if there were some way I could, like, no, I'm not going to pursue it. Because his interest isn't even piqued. And the other reason that that's weird is that he had been having an affair with Naomi Singer, who had also been sleeping with Tom Berenger's character.
Right.
So there was, like, this weird love triangle, and you would think that Zeke would have a suspicion that Tom Berenger had killed her. Right? Because he probably has some insight into her psyche. And yet he never brings up, like, is Tom Berenger a super creepy weirdo? That's never a scene.
Yeah.
It's just never.
Well, no, doesn't he talk to Sharon Stone about that, though? He's like, I don't like that guy.
I think he says, I don't like that
Tom
guy, but
Berenger
I thought it was
says
after.
It a lot about Zeke.
I think it was after Tom Berenger was like, he's so sick.
Yeah.
But so the only thing I can say in defense of this is that I don't think that Billy Baldwin's character would want anyone to know about his video room.
Yeah.
So he would never want to produce these tapes because, like, his whole life is about, like, watching the people in this building.
Right.
Yeah.
And so if he had to admit, like, how he had this footage, like, he would probably go to jail. Like, he'd lose the building.
But couldn't he be sneaky and be like, oh, I see what happened, and now I'm going to, like, figure out how to build a case against Tom Berenger?
I
don't know. We could write a remake.
We should.
I feel like the whole idea of it is that, like, that the access to all this stuff that he's been recording makes him, like, completely amoral. Or, like, like, he doesn't think about things in that way anymore. It all becomes entertainment to him.
Or he has this sort of alternate morality. Like, he's the whole thing about, like, he's watching this father molest his daughter, and he, like, figures out a way to, like, confront the father. And then he tells Sharon Stone, like, we'll use our voyeurism for good.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Which is, like, I don't know. I mean, he's just represents, like, all of tech culture now. We don't need to bring actual law enforcement or anything. We'll just have a very questionable moderation system in place that may or may not work depending on the whims of the people who are in control of it.
And I find this, like, that aspect of the movie to be absolutely fascinating.
Totally.
And the way that it ties, it, like, sort of is perpendicular and, like, hits up with this stuff of, like, a woman trying to find herself sexually is, I think, really good.
it's a story of falling in love with Big Daddy Data. The ending, the alternate ending thing is like, I don't know, it doesn't really work for me. I was totally expecting it to be a switcheroo where it's like, the guy you think is creepy all along wasn't that creepy.
I was expecting to. I mean, I was like, they wouldn't set up Tom Berenger's character as being this unlikable and then have him be the person who was doing this. Like, he has to be a red herring.
Yeah.
We should note that what actually happens in the movie that was released is that Sharon Stone, like, quasi-accidentally kills Tom Berenger. And then in the video room, she, like, basically is like, hey, Billy Baldwin, like, I haven't eaten. Could you go get takeout?
Yeah.
And then he leaves her alone and she goes into his closet and finds his tapes that like show that Tom Berenger was the real killer. Mm-hmm. But then she takes a gun and shoots all the TV monitors
and she says,
of Billy Baldwin's $6 million setup.
What is her last line? Because it's one of those things where it's
get
like
a life.
Get a life, she says.
And then hard cut
credits.
To black.
Yes. It's amazing. I laughed out loud. I howled at that. That's one of the best credit cuts.
I kept going back because I was like, is that really what she said? It's astounding that it plays out that way.
It's just funny because that is the most 90s thing about it, I think. Like, that's the one thing that feels old is that, like, that kind of like get a life about anybody who's like like into video games or into like the internet or anything like that. Like, computers are for nerds. But little did we know. I mean, like, I kind of want to watch it again because I feel like it's got such an odd balance, and I think a lot of it is probably because of that changed ending. Like, I mean, I wrote down the thing about the volcano because he does mention to her that he has always wanted to fly into a volcano when she's at his apartment, Zeke does.
Because he has this, like, creepy glass phallic model of a volcano on his coffee
but
table.
But it's like, without knowing that that was the original ending, it just sounds like a really, really strange double entendre. Like, I'd love to fly into your volcano sometime. Like, do you have, like, I wrote down all of his messages. Like, do you have any body parts that hurt? I miss you. I can still smell you. Like, and then the clip art of the rose. Oh, God. Yeah. No, it's the stuff with the surveillance comes so late in it that I think, like, if I was to remix this movie, that would come at least halfway through, like, where she would get involved in it and become the person who's watching stuff, because then that feels like what the movie's actually about in a way. It feels like it takes a really long time to get there, and then once you get there, you're like, oh, okay, I see what this has all been about. But I thought it was I was into it.
it definitely belonged in the discussion.
Absolutely.
Of the erotic thriller. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask Karina, like, how she felt the kind of erotic thriller boom, like, has its place in this history. Because I didn't realize how many erotic thrillers just exploded after Fatal Attraction.
Yeah.
But again, repping that erotic thriller Wikipedia that someone did the Lord's work on. I was like, nice.
Yeah.
Over 300 and maybe closer to 500 erotic thrillers produced in the 90s, which is like, just seems... we have a lot of work to do, you guys, to see all of these.
And there's levels of highbrow and lowbrow there as well.
Yes, of course. Like,
But why do you think, like, what, besides the kind of, like, VHS direct-to-video kind of, you know, making that a good movie to watch at home? Mm-hmm.
That's definitely part of it. I mean, I think that if you talk about the sort of the historical trajectory, on that Wikipedia page, it says that the first erotic thriller was Double Indemnity, which I think is incorrect. I certainly, like, can think of movies that would qualify that came earlier. And also, I feel like the problem with calling Double Indemnity an erotic thriller is that, like, it begins with Fred McMurray being like, I know, like, everything's over and I'm fucked now, but let me explain to you what happened. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like, it's a bad idea for him to hook up with Barbara Stanwyck. And I feel like part of the thing about erotic thrillers is that you have to, like, suspend disbelief, and there has to be, like, a portion of the movie where you're like, this is hot. Like, maybe this will work out.
Yeah.
So
9.5
weeks
style.
But that movie is, like, wildly sexy, too. Like, I saw it somewhat recently and I was like, it's very, like not at all veiled in its sexuality, and, like, you know, all these ladies throwing themselves at Fred McMurray. It's
but I mean, I think that the reason why there obviously, like, weren't as many erotic thrillers until, you know, let's say the late 60s into the 70s is because of the censorship.
Right.
You know, there was coded, literally coded ways in which you could have sexuality in films, and especially the way that you'd have to have somebody be punished if they were having premarital or extramarital sex.
It's the same with heist movies, too. They always get punished. Yeah. You don't have a successful heist
crime
for a very
can't
long time.
Play. Right. So, and that stuff starts to break down in the 60s. And then you also have this wave of filmmakers like Brian De Palma. They're the first generation of like film school or cinephile American filmmakers who've grown up watching Hitchcock, grown up watching films like, you know, these proto-erotic thrillers like film noirs, The Postman Always Rings Twice, things like this. And then Bob Rafelson like remakes The Postman Always Rings Twice. Like, you know, even something like Chinatown is like a kind of sexier update of these previous genre films. And then moving into the 80s and 90s, you have the explosion of the home video market, the explosion of cable TV, and the possibility of being able to get around the rating system by releasing director's cuts and unrated versions of films. And so you have an incentive to like have a movie that like can be released theatrically as an R and then have a separate version to get people to pay for it twice.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah.
It's like the perfect genre for that stage of the medium.
Yeah.
So is this your favorite one in the canon, would you say, or do you have any other faves?
I mean, this is kind of a sentimental favorite, I would say. Yeah. And another one that I also remember seeing in the movie theater at too young an age and went to by myself was Indecent Proposal.
Oh, yeah.
I really like Adrian Lyne or Adrian Lyne's movies. I wish he'd make another one.
Yeah.
A few years ago, he announced that he was making a movie with Nicole Kidman, and
Oh my God.
I hope that happens.
Put it out. We'll put it out on the airwaves.
We're officially, like, this is an Adrian. In this house, we respect Adrian Lyne. Like, that is our
big time.
That between Fatal Attraction and 9½ Weeks, it's like we're all in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love 9½ Weeks. I love Unfaithful.
Yeah.
Oh, Unfaithful's so good. I feel like we might have to talk about that if this erotic odyssey continues deep into the future.
And another one I just wanted to mention, it's a movie that I didn't really like at first, but has really grown on me over time, is In the Cut.
That's what I hear. In the Cut really like grows on people. They can't really let it go, and then you become fond of it.
I wrote a big thing in graduate school about it and Meg Ryan and like her kind of using the erotic thriller as a way of changing her persona.
Yeah.
And kind of like comparing that movie to When Harry Met Sally, where like that persona was like, I like fake orgasms. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like I don't have genuine sexual pleasure. And then In the Cut is like, you know, she's just like naked with Mark Ruffalo in a very exciting way.
This has been great. I'm really glad you could come by and talk to us about this. And
yes, thank you so much, Karina.
Cool. It was really fun.
You are the original podcast girl in hoodie adjacent person. So we have to shout out Karina. I don't know if we mentioned that she was at the first Night Call Night event where we summoned Satan at Tate's restaurant.
There'll be an oral history of that night someday.
There will be. Yes. So we're forever indebted to Karina. Thank you so much for coming by.
And where can people follow you online?
I'm on Twitter at Karina Longworth, and you can find my podcast, You Must Remember This, on iTunes or wherever you get podcasts. There's 145 episodes, and hopefully someday there will be more.
It's like
not quite
plenty to get. Yeah, it's like enough to keep you busy for a long time, and it's really, really great. It's always a good listen.
Thanks.
Well, thank you everybody for listening to Night Call this week. Be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes and give us a rating and a review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Night Call Pod, Instagram at Night Call Podcast, and Facebook at Night Call Podcast. We will be back in 2 weeks. We are taking a week off, and we'll have Molly back. The whole gang will be back together. So we will see you then. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.